I'm Zach Massetti of the University of Oklahoma School of International and Area Studies, and I'm joined this morning with Josh Landis, who's also a professor at the School of International and Area Studies. We're joined with United States Army Staff Sergeant Eric Maddox, who's a native of Enid and Sepulpa, Oklahoma, and a 1994 OU grad in political science. He was deployed to Iraq in July 2003 and posted to Tikrit, the hometown of Saddam Hussein. His job was to interrogate prisoners who had the potential to yield important information. His new book, Mission, Blacklist, Number 1, tells of the hunt for Saddam Hussein and his closest subordinates. Staff Sergeant Maddox, in your book, you talk about how you found no system for screening detainees to identify priority targets when you began your mission. What was the situation like when you arrived in country in the summer of 2003?
When I arrived to Iraq in 2003, I was initially assigned to Baghdad. I was there a couple of days with the Special Operations Task Force to go after the high-value targets, specifically Saddam. I was then sent to Tikrit, and my primary mission was just to determine the guilt or innocence of the prisoners which had been captured. From that, I began conducting interrogations of dozens and then hundreds of prisoners, and eventually an unknown insurgency element unfolded within Tikrit.
How did you determine, though, with all these hundreds of detainees, how did you determine who was a high-value target and who was not?
Well, when I arrived in Tikrit, they had already established high-value targets based upon individuals that were under Saddam's regime, individuals who were on the deck of cards, people that were assumed to be high-value targets. I went there and started interrogating extremely low-level insurgents, and I simply allowed their information to guide and then develop what I determined to actually be the high-value targets. I didn't look at who was supposed to be supporting Saddam. I allowed the prisoners to, like I said, unfold this insurgency that was unknown, and then from them build high-value targets of people I believed could take us to Saddam.
You describe also in the book a giant sort of link, a diagram that you put down on paper eventually. What was that?
It was just that. We started with a scratch piece of paper, and we built from both the top and then the bottom. The top, of course, being Saddam, and then at the bottom being all the players who had then their leader and the next chain of command. And then along those chain of commands, we had links off to their social networks, people who were drivers for them, people who would provide them harbor, weapons, equipment, or simply food, and they would become part of this large link diagram and see the connections, which allowed you sort of a roadmap towards the top of to Saddam.
How do you describe your interrogation technique? What did you talk a little bit about, because you were a new interrogator, someone who was new to the field. What did you do differently that others hadn't perhaps done before?
Well, I was a new interrogator in that I had not conducted interrogations. I wasn't that new to the field. It was simply that the profession of interrogations for the U.S. military wasn't one that was needed up until 9/11. It had taken a significant hiatus since the Vietnam War. We had a little bit of interrogations through those 30 years. So myself, along with the majority of interrogators, had not conducted interrogations. I realized was that what my training was for me to interrogate individuals that were from a German military wearing a uniform with a smoking gun. Iraq was a situation where there was no soldiers. You were dealing with insurgent members. So you had to relate to them, and the approaches I was taught in interrogation were not going to be effective with civilian insurgents in the battlefield of Iraq.
You know, you talk also in the book about why it's equally important to find out why a prisoner is lying as it is to find out what information that person is hiding.
Most of the time when I begin an interrogation with a prisoner, I have no idea what information that they're hiding. What I do realize, though, is that when you hide information, you do that through your lies. So I'll simply conduct an interview with a prisoner to learn all about their life, all the intricate details, and to determine what they're hiding from me. I will allow those lies to guide me towards the information they're hiding, because I don't know what they're hiding. And I focus on those subjects, which will then unveil the information they're hiding.
You know, one of the things also I thought that was refreshing in your book is that you admit you made mistakes or that you lost your temper at times. How does that play into the interrogation technique?
Well, the mistakes that I made, I felt like, were what allowed me to grow as an interrogator. And I think the key to being a really successful interrogator is to be able to do self-analyzation, to be able to look at how you did questioning your techniques and then go and make those adjustments. I felt like when I lost my temper, it simply was a matter of me losing focus on what I was trying to get accomplished and maybe blaming the prisoner for not providing information, not talking. So again, you lose your temper. I didn't lose it in a violent way. I just simply lost it, lost my focus, and had to refocus. But again, when you look back and you can learn from those mistakes, your next interrogation is going to be better.
So how did you catch Saddam Hussein? What led you to him? And how did you figure out how to get to him?
Halfway through my tour, so about mid-October, a couple of hundred interrogations, I finally went to my team leader and explained to him there is an unknown insurgency element into Crete. And at the top of it are three brothers and a cousin who are former Inner Circle bodyguards to Saddam. I think we need to focus on them and their social networks, friends and families. From October to December, that's exactly what my 12-man team, special operation, special task force going after Saddam, that's what we did. So we went from October to November to December, individual, raid their house, brought them back to me. I did the interrogation to the next target, to the next target. Finally, on December 12th, 2003, we went on a raid hoping to find one of these brothers, one of the only individuals I believe could take us to Saddam Hussein. We captured his lieutenant. We didn't think we captured him. I interrogated the lieutenant on the morning of December 13th, and he finally told me, yes, Muhammad Ibrahim, this individual I thought could take us to Saddam, was at the house. So I realized he was one of our prisoners. Went back to the cell, unhooded the gentleman, and realized that this was Muhammad Ibrahim. At 6 o'clock in the morning, I started interrogating. 2 hours later, he finally admitted, yes, I'm running the insurgency under Saddam, and I'll take you to him.
Now, why did he admit that? Why didn't he keep it secret?
Through this four-month process, once our team focused on this Muhammad Ibrahim and his family, we went after all of his family members, which he had gotten tied into the insurgency. So by December, we had captured over 40 members of his family that were in our custody. I explained to Muhammad Ibrahim, those 40 individuals are here because you've got them tied up in this insurgency. I then named another 20 individuals from his family and said, I know exactly where they live. They're involved in the insurgency because of you. If you don't take me to Saddam, we're going after them. So essentially, him taking us to Saddam would get his entire family released from prison and no longer sought after by the U.S. military. We had that debate back and forth, and he finally agreed, yes, let's go.
But, you know, intelligence is often, they say, is 5% insight, 95% patience. So there's a certain amount of patience here, but there were also, I think, in those months leading up to this day in December, there were all sorts of breaks that you got. And one of the things I thought that was interesting was Saddam's favorite fish became a little clue in terms of how you unlocked this puzzle.
It was. Early in August, I had an opportunity to interrogate Saddam's servant, individual who served him food every day of his reign as leader of Iraq. And he explained that Saddam would eat this particular type of cooked fish, masguf, twice a day. So from that, when we started going along hunting towards Saddam, the individuals I believe could take us towards him were believed to have owned this fish farm just next to the Tigris River down in Samarra. So it was a lead that we need to focus to that location because Saddam needs his fish. He's got to have it, yet he can't go to the market. His people can't go to the market. So why wouldn't they raise the fish at this fish farm? We did that raid on December 7th, and we captured individuals that were critical in the process to the December 13th capture of Saddam.
Now, you had a clock ticking on you because you were going to be deployed out of the country. You had a deadline. How did you manage to get this information so quickly?
The deadline was December 13th, 2003. Now, when you say so quickly, had I got it done quickly, I wouldn't have led to the last minute of my deployment. But unfortunately, we couldn't get to the pieces of the puzzle until December 13th. Now, I had to leave at 8 o'clock in the morning, like it or not, on December 13th. My interrogation of Mohammed Ibrahim started December 13th at 6 o'clock in the morning. I simply explained to him, it's you and me. I'm the person that knows you can take us to Saddam. I'm the person that is responsible for the capture of 40 of your family members and 20 that we haven't got yet. You are the only person that can take us to Saddam, and that's the only thing we are going to discuss. So we cut straight through the chase. My knowledge of him and his knowledge of me and my work allowed us to cut through all the preliminaries. We got straight to the debate.
So how did you capture him? Were you there when you captured Saddam Hussein?
No. This gentleman, Mohammed Ibrahim, told me at 7:45, yes, I will take you to Saddam. We quickly drew a sketch. I called my team in Tikrit and says, we got him. We got Mohammed Ibrahim. Come get him. He's ready to go to Saddam. I had to catch a plane out of the country at 8 o'clock in the morning. 12 hours later, my team in Tikrit comes down, picks up Mohammed Ibrahim. They go back to Tikrit, conduct a raid, 2,000 hours on December 13th, did a raid of the farmhouse. Initially could not find Saddam. They took Mohammed Ibrahim, who on December 12th was the leader of the Iraqi insurgency under Saddam. He led them directly to the spider hole, and that's how we got Saddam.
So you're actually in Heathrow Airport, right? You're on your way back to the United States at the time?
I was not yet in Heathrow. I was in Doha, Qatar. I was there to brief CENTCOM, General Abizade's staff, on how close we were to Saddam. Now, I was being escorted by the head of our task force, a Navy admiral. Once we got to Doha, Qatar, when I finally said, sir, last night, we didn't think we got Mohammed Ibrahim. We actually captured him. He ready to take us to Saddam. He said, Eric, you have to brief CENTCOM. I'm going back. We'll get him.
All of this was done, though all of these techniques were done without any kind of what would be called torture, right? It was done without waterboarding, was done without any kind of extreme techniques. Why was it successful without torture, or why do you feel that you, standard techniques led to the capture of such a high-value target?
The method that I tried to employ was that I needed something from these individuals, but it was going to be their choice to give it to me. So I had to create an environment for them to where by them providing me the information I wanted would actually be beneficial to them. For instance, I've got a member of the insurgency. I want him to give me a higher member. Now, when I explain to him, I know who that individual is. I know you can take me. I also know your family members who are in the insurgency can take me to that higher member. If you take me, I don't have to go capture them. If you take me, you're no longer involved. You're out of this trap. You can be a free man. Your family's no longer going to be sought after. And yet I still get the individual above him in the insurgency. To me, that's very simple. That is clean cut, simple math. I help them. They help me. To do that, I cannot have beaten or tortured or coerced these individuals because I'm basically caretaker of their family. To have the initially beaten, torture these individuals and then ask them to trust me, it would be completely counterproductive.
Well, let me ask you, I know you're still, you're a member of the Department of Defense, but is waterboarding torture?
Absolutely. It's not only is it torture, it's illegal. It's not taught. I'd never seen a waterboard till probably 2003. I finally went on YouTube to figure out what everyone was talking about. I'd never heard of it. I believe it was initiated in a SEER training and then was somehow implemented, but it's not condoned, it's illegal, and I just don't know how it can be effective. I'm there to get prisoners to talk. To make them drown and to pour water down their throat, I'm curious how that's going to allow them to talk.
I'm Zach Massetti. I'm a professor of International and Area Studies here at the University of Oklahoma, and I'm with Joshua Landis, who's also a professor of International and Area Studies. We're joined by Staff Sergeant Eric Maddox, who was involved in the capture of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, and you're listening to Oklahoma Voices on KGOU.
What went wrong at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo? How did America get onto this? How did it start to go down that road of abusing prisoners?
Abu Ghraib was a situation where there was a lack of leadership and a lack of guidance. At Abu Ghraib, none of the individuals who are guards were trained to be prison guards. And a lot of the leadership and responsible for Abu Ghraib, that was not what they were trained to do. So they didn't know how to guard prisoners. They didn't know how to conduct the interrogation of these prisoners. So essentially, as the uncertainty of what they wanted to gather from them, the uncertainty of how to treat them starts to allow them to misinterpret the rules of engagement. And then you have a circumstance where it got to be such a rough environment down with the prisoners that senior leadership wouldn't even enter into the prison. So you had these prison guards who didn't want to be there, who thought they had carte blanche to do whatever they want, and there was no leadership, was even afraid to go in there to view what was going on, that it really it's a case study that we shouldn't put under the rug and hide. We should look at it, look at the problems, and learn from it.
You know, one of the criticisms of your book that I've read is that really it stops at the end of this story, which is December 2003. And that events, of course, in 2004, 5, and 6 were very difficult in Iraq for the United States military. If you had to write a postscript for the book, if you had to sort of talk about the aftermath of the capture of Saddam Hussein, so by this I mean his trial and his execution and other events that occurred in Iraq in the years after you left, what would you say?
I would say that one of the things I don't think the world knows, that the U.S. public knows, is that Saddam Hussein was running the insurgency throughout the country at the time of his capture. He had transported $4 billion, U.S. dollars, to Syria. He was going to use that money to refund him coming back into power. He had his leadership in place and absolutely could have come back into power. When we captured Saddam Hussein, the insurgency was almost dead. Now, the events that occurred at Abu Ghraib and the photos that came out re-energized now the foreign fighter insurgency who started to come into the country. My story is simply the events, the tracking down of Saddam up to that point. We had an opportunity to finish it off at that time. The mistakes that just naturally happened. There's nothing we can do about it now. It would have been great to have seen what was going on and stop it. But once those occurred, a new insurgency evolved, a completely separate insurgency evolved. So I understand some readers were disappointed because the book just stopped, but that was the end of that story. Different events caused the next insurgency to arise.
You've served in Afghanistan on 2 tours, if I believe. You investigated people in Afghanistan. Why haven't we caught Osama bin Laden like you caught Saddam Hussein? What's so different?
The biggest problem is when going after a high-value target that is in one country and the U.S. military forces are in a separate country. Osama bin Laden, I believe, is in Pakistan. U.S. forces are in Afghanistan. Now, it's not just that the combat forces can't go across to capture or kill him. It's that the intelligence collectors are in Afghanistan. So when I'm investigating, looking for clues of Osama bin Laden, I have to run every single clue, thousands of leads to the ground, because 99.9 are going to be wrong. They're not going to be accurate. They're going to be junk. Well, I have to figure out which ones are the bad leads to focus on the good ones. But when every single lead I have in Afghanistan stops at the border, I can't discredit any of them. All of them are still valid because I can't guarantee that they're the wrong leads. So we're at a situation now in 2009, we've got hundreds and thousands of leads that may have been accurate, probably are not, but we can't discredit any of them because they all stop at the Afghan-Pakistan border.
So when we hit into Pakistan with drones and do these military operations, in a sense we're poking around semi-blind and hitting people that could be, may not be.
I'm not going to speak to the military actions that are going on to Pakistan. I can just simply say, as an individual who's worked in Afghanistan looking for individuals in Pakistan, that the key to being able to narrow down your target from a wide fan into a precise laser target is being able to track the accuracy of the lead. And when every single lead stops at the border, you're left with this large fan. So if you are then asked to do military operation, your target is a wide region and not a specific location such as a spider hole.
But every single lead doesn't stop at the border. We have intelligence that we collect in Pakistan that surely comes back. I mean, and we've pulled targets. Miramal Kanzi, I think, who was the fellow who shot people in front of CIA headquarters in the early 1990s, was caught in Karachi in the early 90s. So surely there's some information here that an interrogator has that's reliable that's coming in.
Any information that comes in from these types of individuals is valuable information. But to follow the chain of events, as I did to find Saddam, you start from the bottom, and you must keep that chain connected through the social networks. When you find a high-value target, as you just mentioned, in Pakistan, now you're just hoping. Let's hope this guy knows where bin Laden is and will tell us. But the way I produce my intelligence is by doing these interrogations to determine who exactly knows where they are. Then I start back at the bottom with their social networks and work your way up. Every time I started at the bottom and I'm working my way up the social network, it stopped at the border.
So when you were into Crete, you could just tell your guys, go out and pick up all these people for me. What percentage of the people into Crete did you have on your slips of paper? What percentage of the town, of the larger area, did you know?
First of all, I'd like to say that I had no authority to tell anyone to do anything. I was one of the lowest ranking members of this task force. These are the most elite soldiers on the planet. So the first thing I had to do was convince them that the information I was gathering was accurate and propose to them that this is an avenue for us to go find Saddam. When they bought off on that, then we proceeded. Just to correct that,
right, sure.
I wasn't in charge. That was the hardest challenge I had, was to convince individuals above me to use this plan. Of the individuals into Crete, I felt like I had a solid handle on every single significant family. When I say family, families, tribes, sub-tribes, you have 200 or 300 individuals. Once the focus came down, though, on this specific family of al-Muslits, I felt very comfortable. I knew every single al-Muslit to the child, mothers, cousins in the entire tribe, and I sort of stopped investigating the other families. So I had a decent handle on most of Tikrit, but this tribe, I knew them certainly as well as they knew themselves.
But what about the idea or the criticism that, you know, you had the ability to basically detain everyone or anyone, regardless of innocence or guilt, you could detain and question them? This is a criticism that, you know, this doesn't comply sort of with our standard of American standard of how of justice.
I completely understand that, and I agree that that appears to be unjust. When I say I could, we could go capture and interrogate anyone, what I'm referring to is anyone that has knowledge of the insurgency. So therefore, they are guilty of having knowledge of the insurgent activities. I'm not going out there and capturing members of this al-Muslit family, the one who eventually took us to Saddam, simply because they're relatives, in hopes that that's going to persuade some of the active family members to come in and talk. No, I was going after the members that on the peripheral were involved in the insurgency, but they possibly never conducted an attack, never set off an IED, never transported weapons, but yet they harbored a family member knowing exactly what they were doing. We went after them for the information, and we felt that we were allowed to do that due to their knowledge.
So finally, if you were in a place like Guantanamo, where you have prisoners who are isolated from their environment, and you don't have any control over them, you can't let them go if they give you what you want, how do you get... You know, that's a completely different environment than the one you're describing in Tikrit, where you could pursue all kinds of avenues. You were at great liberty to figure out the best way to get information. How do you function in a very different environment like that? You're going to be going down to Houston. You're going to be dealing with people in a not similar situation, but who are isolated from their environment. How do you get information out of somebody like that?
I first would say that I don't personally believe that the interrogation intelligence collection in Guantanamo Bay is gathering very useful information. You're talking about Al-Qaeda members and insurgent members that were captured back in 2001, 2002, 2003. Their information is 6 years old. With the rapid change of the global war on terrorism and the turnover, because we are putting a major dent in the leadership and the direction, I have no reason to believe that there is very useful, accurate information that we can glean from these individuals. I've never been to Guantanamo Bay, and I would choose to ask them to send me to a battlefield that has more current prisoners. We can get more useful and accurate information. That being said, I think what I would do with these prisoners is create such a comfortable environment, so far to the right of what the line of the minimum amount of things that they can provide, and then slowly ask them to cooperate with me, having given them, you know, radios, newspapers, bunkmates, friends, anything they want for an extended period of time. And then as I start talking to them, once I identify that they're being deceptive, they're not providing me the information I want, slowly start removing these things. Because no one's going to accuse me of being torture if I take a guy's flat screen away. Yet when he sets that level of expectation as his standard, imagine if somebody took your television away or whatever the things that are most useful, necessary to your life in a prison environment. So you set the bar so high, that way you are allowed to take things away. You're not even close to the line of torture or illegal methods of collection.
You know, you mentioned maybe we can end this on a lighter note, something that's important to you, and you read it throughout your book, and you're a very big OU football fan, and you talk about it in your book as something that, to a certain extent, was a release for you while you were in Iraq. Describe that a little bit.
I am. I grew up an OU football fan. I'm native Oklahoman. Obviously, I love Oklahoma football. And one of the things I wanted to mention in the book was how important Oklahoma football is to so many soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines in a battlefield. And I know that the worlds are so completely different. In a war, it's survival. And in here, as important as Oklahoma football is, it's entertainment, and it's a way for young men to, you know, play a sport they love and also get an education. But it is a critical element when you're in a battlefield environment. It's so important that I had 3 or 4 hours out of the week where I could completely separate from the war and watch. Okay, there's a sign of happiness, because the war zone it's brutal. It's awful. Everyone's very depressed and on end. And just to be able to sit back and look and see 80,000 Oklahomans happy and unified under that team, I really can't describe to Coach Stoops and the rest of the players. I hope they realize how important they are to so many people in the military.
Well, Staff Sergeant Eric Maddox, thank you so much for joining us today on Oklahoma Voices.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.